Good. That makes for a nice literate audience interested in what we're going to be talking about. That's good. Okay. This evening, we are beginning the spring semester for our White House Communications course through the lens of officials and reporters. And during the semester, we're going to be interviewing officials who currently work in the White House and then some who have worked in White House's past, so that we get a sense of their view of communications, of presidential communications, and what it is, get a sense of what it is they're trying to do, how they're trying to communicate the president's image and message. And equally important for us is the viewpoint of reporters and what they're trying to do, how they see their job, who they represent, and how they do their work. And we're beginning with a photojournalist, Christopher Morris, who works for Time magazine and who has had a varied career that he brings to his White House photography. He has been a war photographer as well as a White House photographer. And I think what we might do is start with a discussion with Chris about his work, how he got into photojournalism, and what he sees his role as being. And then he's going to walk us through some of his pictures, his war photography, and then his White House photographs. In looking at the White House photographs, he might have seen the Time Man of the Year issue that came out at the beginning of the year. And Chris took pictures. He was the one who took the photographs of President Bush for that issue. Chris, can you tell us, how did you get into the business?
I just knew early on as a young age that I wanted to be a photographer. I had seen professional photographers in my youth. I'd lived overseas. And at the end of the Vietnam War, when the POWs, the prisoners of war, were released, uh-huh. I actually saw photographers, professional photographers, and it looked like a very unique occupation. Uh-huh. I was in the eighth grade at the time.
Where were you?
Clark Air Base in the Philippines.
Uh-huh.
My father worked as a contractor overseas during the Vietnam War, so uh-huh. I went to live with my father. And it just seemed like, because a photographer, it was interesting, there were all these ropes and barriers, but photographers, they were on the roofs of the buildings, they could go where, you know, they weren't told they couldn't go anywhere, they could kind of go, they were kind of around. And then I started to notice the photography that was coming out of the end of the Vietnam War. I started to notice newspaper photography of conflict, of like uh-huh. war photography, and it just, that was the first time I put a face that there was actually a person there taking a picture of somebody, of these acts that I was seeing, and it just amazed me that photographers were allowed to go photograph conflict, war, and all that. So I became very interested in that, and then when in high school I was a yearbook photographer and editor, and I just was determined that I wanted to be a photojournalist.
So uh-huh. that's kinda how I started. What kind of pictures did you take when you were in high school?
The typical yearbook stuff. You do all the sports, the uh-huh. everything. But I also found that high school, it was like the best job in high school, because it gave you an excuse to get out of class, and uh-huh. everybody was your friend. You could go on the fields of the football game. It was just what I had saw from the... as my youth, what I saw of photojournalism, the same thing passed over in high school. You were allowed to go places that you weren't, you had no excuse to be. And that's to me, that's the most unique thing about photojournalism. It gives a photojournalist, they can go anywhere from the Oval Office to the battlefield in Iraq to heads of state. You just get a real interesting perspective on world history.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I was determined to set up to make my career.
When we were looking at the photographs of the Vietnam veterans coming back, what did you see in those photographs that you perhaps didn't see in the stories that were coming out about Vietnam?
I don't think I was old enough uh-huh. to form an opinion on that. I was just more intrigued on the technical end of the photojournalist, more of the historic moment of the POWs coming back. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I was eighth grade. I don't know how old it is. It's like 11 or something. I don't know. I don't really remember. So it was kind of hard. I didn't really have any political feelings about it. I just was intrigued of wanting to witness history at a very young age. And I've been a professional photojournalist for 20 years now. 15 years of that, I've worked for Time magazine. I'm an independent contractor. I'm still self-employed.
How do you work that?
I have a yearly contract. Every year a contract comes up. We agreed to a contract. They pay for all my expenses, and but I retain the copyright to my material. Like the material I just photographed of the president, I own those images. If I was a staff photographer for Time, I would not own those images. So I prefer to to stay an independent contractor.
Then you have a group of photographers.
We formed an agency just prior to September 11th, seven of us, called Seven. It's like a photo cooperative. There are different photographers that work for Time, Newsweek, National Geographic, some Europeans, and we formed like a cooperative because we own our material and we market our material overseas. After, let's say, the Bush material, after Time is finished with it, the next week I can sell that material to the French, the Germans, the Japanese, the Italians. So that's basically what the sub-agency is for, called Seven.
So that's a very independent kind of career, in a sense, that you have. Of having that much control over your material, which is not true of reporters.
We can also turn things down. Like, I work now 1 month on, 1 month off. I work 30 days at the White House, and then I'm off 30 days. And if something comes up, like the inauguration was in my off month, they want asked me if I wanted to do it, I could say no, I didn't want to cover it. I'm not like forced. You're not forced to do anything. They can't like say, we're going to send you to Iraq tomorrow and you're going to go to Iraq. Where if you're staff, those issues can be a little more difficult.
Right. But let's go back and back to your, let's say, after you finished high school. What did you do after you left high school?
I went to an art school in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, just to learn the craft. I didn't want to go to a, I knew I wanted to be a photographer, and but I also at the time wanted to have a lot of fun, so I ended up at an art school in Fort Lauderdale. I interned at the Miami Herald while I was there, and from that I produced a portfolio that I sent to New York to a well-known school called the International Center of Photography, and I received a scholarship to go to New York, and ended up in New York, and that's kind of, I just ended up in New York and discovered the different, there's like photo agencies, and started interning at a photo agency, and then slowly worked my way up, and that's kind of how I broke into the business.
How do you learn how to take pictures when you're, like to say, when you were in art school? How much do you really learn in school? What kinds of things do you learn there?
I learned a lot in school. You learn a lot of the technical craft,
parts,
the creative. And it's like you have to have some creative, you know, I don't know if you're born with it or what, like painters are, but you have to be able to see. But somebody has to teach you the craft, how to physically do it. It's like a writer. Somebody has to teach a writer probably how to structure properly and structure a good story.
Were there any particular photographers whose work that you were interested in?
At the time, when I ended up in New York, that's when I discovered, you know, the history of photography. When I went to ICP in New York, and I fell in love with the work of Don McCullen, who was a British photographer who covered Vietnam, a lot of the conflicts through the 70s. And there was David Douglas Duncan, who was a photographer during the Korean War and the Vietnam War. Just, I became fascinated with basically war photography.
What attracts you to war photography?
Now I'm not really attracted to it, but at the time I was attracted to the, it was very pure, fashion photography, sports photography, all of it's all kind of like staged, even covering the White House, it's all very staged, it's not very real. You can be a great sport photographer, a great fashion photographer, but you're photographing something that's created for you. With war photography, it's very fluid. I just felt that it was the purest form of photography, in the sense that it's just kind of very raw and pure. You can't really manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to, I mean, there are things that are staged, there are things that are set up, but if you're a true photojournalist, you don't do that. And to come out and to be known as a really good war photographer, I think it's quite difficult.
Uh-huh.
Because the photography is so difficult. There's people don't realize if there's a conflict happening in the country, how do you physically get yourself to that place? What are you going to eat? What are you going to sleep? How are you going to get the images out? The photography is only probably 10 or 15% of it. The other rest is basically survival and all that. And the thing with me, there was nobody to teach me that. I made a lot of mistakes early on, and eventually you become quite good at it the more you do it.
You seem to, if you have your limbs.
Yeah.
You haven't been shot, have you?
No.
Uh-huh.
I've been shot at, but not at.
Yeah. The casualty rate really has seemed very high for war photographers.
In the Yugoslav conflict, which I covered a lot from the beginning, in the first 6 months, there were around 30 journalists killed in the first 6 months. It was almost like one a week. And they're usually photographers and cameramen.
Uh-huh.
Because photographers and cameramen, if there is fighting three blocks from here, a still photographer can't be here to photograph it. He has to go there. A writer can stay back and be here and write. He can interview people that are coming from the battle, and he can create great color from that. But as a still photographer, you can't do that. And if you go when it's even after it's over, you have to kind of be there to be able to get really good photography.
How did you learn the process of how you set yourself up to be where you want to be?
You hook up with other people that are that are good, or your peers that you see, people that have done it. You ask to ride with them or spend time with them. And then there's just a lot of good common sense that you learn to develop. Rely on instinct. I don't know if you want to start.
Yes, let's start. And then
first.
Yeah.
To give them an idea. We're talking about this. They don't have an idea. This first body of work, I've actually covered over 20 conflicts in a 20-year period. I've done all the U.S. invasions, everything from Panama, Central America, conflicts in Africa, Liberia, Somalia, all the different conflicts I've pretty much covered. The body of work I'm going to show is one that I'm fondest of, just because it was probably the most intense that I had covered. It was in the former Soviet Republic of Chechnya. They broke away. They tried to gain independence. And the Russians basically attacked. It was Christmas of 94. The Russians, there was a leader, Dudayev. They tried to capture him in a presidential palace. And this is my body of work from that. And you can go ahead.
Can you tell us kind of how you got there, what the situation was, and where these individual pictures
It was interesting. It was,
I was
with my girlfriend at the time, and I had told her we would get married before the end of the year, and it was coming up. And we actually flew to Las Vegas and got married on New Year's Eve. And by January 3rd, I was in Grozny doing, basically you have to have, I always retained a multiple entry journalist visa to former Soviet Union from around 89, just because of it was so fluid there. And if you didn't have a visa, it was difficult to get a visa quickly.
So how many visas can you keep open?
Well, back then you kind of watch. If I was doing that type of work today, I would watch. Like I just when you see Ukraine, you immediately get a Ukrainian visa. Usually try to have two passports so you can juggle them around. If you probably try to get a Sudanese visa. You read the New York Times, you kind of see what's going on in the world, and you need to know what the visa requirements are for different countries. Go ahead and change the slide.
So can you tell us about
the different images? Like this is actually like a 15-year-old. I basically spent all my time with the Chechens fighting, and this is actually in a building. It's a 14-year-old fighter. He's actually just fired on Russian positions. Basically, they do like room-to-room fighting. And the reason I like the work so much, it was what I had saw from Don McCullen and David Douglas Duncan of like close-quarter combat, like the pictures that came out of Fallujah recently. It's very rare to have an opportunity to do that type of photography.
How did you get there?
Flew to Russia, and then you take a commercial plane down to one of the neighboring republics.
Then you hire a car,
usually for a lot of money, anywhere from $100 to $500, to try to drive you as close to the fighting as he will go. And then they usually just drop you off and turn around and leave.
Uh-huh.
And usually you probably might have to walk anywhere from a kilometer to 10 kilometers to reach where the conflict is. And then you find, and basically being a foreigner, a lot of people say, do you have a translator with me? I didn't like working with a translator because I always felt guilty of dragging somebody into a conflict situation if he was hurt or killed.
Uh-huh.
Translators would usually make around $100 a day, and I felt guilty, so I used to try to do it on my own. Usually you could find some people to speak English. And then you get in, and the people see that you're a foreigner, the Chechens, and they basically take you in, and they know what you're there for. You're there to try to get to the front lines to take pictures. And now you're in. And it was pre-digital and kind of pre-sat phone, so you have film. So usually you would stay like three weeks till you produce the body of work, and then you would try to get out to ship film.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and change the song.
So can you tell us about each of the pictures?
Well, this is the last one was somebody that was just killed on the street, and they were trying to evacuate him. This is a Chechen fighter in the presidential palace, which was basically completely surrounded by the Russians, and they were trying to take the presidential palace.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I like the pictures because I know what it took to get to that place. To me, it was the most dangerous place on earth at that time because there's a lot of firepower, you know, being put on that. And I just spent one afternoon there. But physically getting in and getting out is the hard part.
How long did it take to get in?
Several days, actually, to get to that spot. I was within a mile, but it took several days just to go a mile to find somebody that would willingly to take you in because they were cut off. And you can go ahead and change it, keep going.
How do you get to the people who can make the decision that that you can come in?
Well, early on in conflicts, before conflicts get entrenched into a long conflict, when they're very fresh, there's really no, you can show up on the battlefield and you just find a unit and find one of the higher-ups in the unit. There's no like having to get permission from their Department of Defense and wait for letters. It is that way if I was trying to cover it on the Russian side.
Uh-huh.
That's why a lot of us ended up on the Chechen side. It's pretty fluid. You just hook up with a unit, and they feel they're right. They feel they're fighting for a just cause, so they like to have somebody around there to document it. And you can advance it.
What kind of body armor do you wear?
Depends on the situation. Here I wear a very light flak jacket, and I wore a helmet. I wear the light flak jacket just because over the years, I'm not strong enough to wear the really big body armor. I find it slows me down. And these were bodies that were collected, and the Russians had put them into a trench to bury the dead. You know, when in any conflict, even in Iraq, I'll show pictures, they have to go up and clean up after battle. So there's usually, you try to find where whatever army wins, where they collect the dead and wounded and bring them. And they usually, we did it in Panama, we did it in Somalia, we did it in Iraq. They collect bodies and they put them in graves and mass pits and bury them. Mainly for health issues. It's not for like, I don't think it's for censorship issues. It's basically they try to clean up the battlefield.
But they don't like those kind of pictures
taken. Absolutely not. That was not taken with because there were Russians there.
So how did you take it?
Just with camera on the side. You learn, you know, and hopefully you don't get caught. So I had the same problem in Panama. In Panama, I saw the Americans doing the same thing and tried to photograph it and was not successful. It's certain things, certain armies don't want shown. Also in Iraq, you don't see a lot of photographs of that. A lot of the, you know, dead Iraqis.
Uh-huh.
And so, you keep going. With all these pictures, for me, I'm very attached to them. I'm a lot more attached to them than I am to my White House photography, because it's a great risk for me to take that.
Uh-huh.
You're with somebody who's shooting at somebody else, trying to kill somebody else. So that other person is trying to kill him also. And you're in close proximity on a situation.
Can you tell us about that one?
This is actually the Chechens now trying to retake one of the government buildings.
Uh-huh.
And there are actually Russians in the building that we're in, and they're in a basement firing on the building 20, 30 feet away. So I would literally take this picture, and I would not stay more than 5 seconds there, and then I would run. I would run, like, down some hallways and go away, because anything could come into that room, a tank shell, because there's, like, muzzle flash. So those are things you learn. You don't sit around and talk with the guy. You let him shoot, you leave, and you wait to see if anything comes back, and then slowly you creep up and take some more pictures.
Would you have a flash?
No, never.
No flash.
I don't even use flash at the White House.
Uh-huh.
I'm just not big on flash photography.
When you're in that kind of situation and you have people firing on both sides...
you can go back to the other one.
Isn't that something that... doesn't it concern you that you're going to get in the middle of that one?
Yeah, you careful. Like this
you're
here,
get
this
shot?
The picture you're looking at here, this is someone firing an RPG inside a building at a Russian tank. So, and it's loud. You can go ahead and change. You kind of learn where to stand. And since I have two children, I had a child in 1998, and all I did for time was cover conflict, and I was getting tired of it. When my daughter was 2 years old in year 2000, I was back in Chechnya, and I had some very close calls, and I realized that I didn't want to do it anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I told time that to find me something else, you've got to, I just don't want to do it anymore. And because I realized for me, it was now I had something more important in my life than this selfish profession I had chosen. And they offered me to cover the White House. So that's when I started covering the White House.
Uh-huh.
It was just prior to September 11th. You can go ahead.
What do you see as the impact at the time? What were the impact of your pictures?
Well, sometimes there's no impact. You're kind of a historian. You need to make a historic document to show the reality of what's happening. War can be very sanitized, and people can talk about it, about casualty and wounding. But to be there to see people cry over their loved ones, it's just, you know, if you watch the news and you see an Iraqi family crying over their dead father, you know, these people have feelings too. It's just not Americans that grieve. Everybody grieves. You know.
Yeah. Do you find
we're all humans? You can change.
Did have any of your pictures? Did you feel had an impact in that you can, you know, that you can particularly
can't say
point to?
I know in Yugoslavia, some of the market massacres, and during the Clinton administration when. Covering the siege of Sarajevo, you would hear the administration. They would ask him about the humanitarian crisis of Sarajevo, and Clinton would talk in the press conference about there is no humanitarian crisis. The people aren't starving to death. People have food, but when you live there and day to day, you were watching women and children being killed by mortars or snipers. To me, that was the humanitarian crisis.
Yeah.
The people, they weren't worried about food and water. They were worried about having their faces ripped off. And killed. And so that irritated me. And then eventually, but it took a lot of video and a lot of photographs to finally slap the West in the face to get them to finally try to put the stop on it. But it took them a good four years.
Uh-huh. Can you tell us about that picture?
These are just people that were cut down. People don't realize in a combat area, there's mortars and shelling, and you don't know where they come from, and stuff just drops out of the sky. And if you're unlucky enough to be anywhere near it, you can... These were civilians that were out trying to get food that were killed by shrapnel from mortars. And I was with a group of photographers, and we're trying to find the front line for that day, and you just turn a corner, and there's somebody lying there. You know, sometimes you find people that are wounded, and then you have to try to help them. Try to get them a car and get them out. There was an earlier one of a woman crying over a a woman. She was shot in the head.
Uh-huh.
And it was very far from the fighting. It was, I had actually went out to ship film and came back, and we were probably 2-3 miles from the front line, but when bullets are in the air, eventually they come down, and just a stray bullet just came out of the sky and hit her in the head and killed her. So there's all those different change. And these are a group of fighters I was with. You spend a lot of time in basements below ground, and when the shelling stopped, then they come above ground and move. It's interesting because these are all these like Islamic fighters, these hardcore Islamic Chechen fighters that the Russians are now dealing with. But back at that time, they really received this. I would not go back there now because I'd probably, you know, kidnapping. And all.
Uh-huh. How old were they?
They varied from 15 to 60. Mm-hmm. But the bulk of them are in their 20s. Go ahead.
Can you tell us about that?
This is still in the presidential palace. This is me trying to find out. I'm trying to leave now.
Uh-huh.
And every time you come out, and they would say, okay, go ahead and run. And they would cover you. You would have to run outside. And you basically had around 1,000 meters to get in the open.
Uh-huh.
So they would say, okay, go now. And then they would cover for you, and they'd say, run. And it took me like an hour and a half before I got up the nerve to make the run. So this is like me running up to the door, and he would start shooting, so I'd stop to take a picture. And then they'd get angry at me. they're trying to get you so you can leave.
Yeah. So it requires an enormous amount of trust.
Yeah.
On both your parts.
Yeah.
And also in their capacity to actually protect you.
Yes. And this is the same situation.
Uh-huh.
You're basically out in the open, and there's, you know, a lot of fear involved.
Were there other photographers who were there?
I went in with 3 other photographers and a TV crew.
Were all of you going out at the same time?
No, not really. We kind of all got separated in the building. It was a big complex, and I just, you know, wanted out. I didn't want to end up, once it got dark, it became worse.
Yeah.
Then you end up overnight. And
how do you know once you get out and once you go your kilometer, where you're going to go from there?
Well, I found colleagues, and we found some locals in a house, and we stayed in a house.
Uh-huh.
Yep. That's like the first thing you do when you get to a place is find out where you're going to sleep, how you're going to eat.
Mm-hmm. So you get those basics.
Get the basics
down. Yeah. What about them?
They were watching the battle. They were Chechen snipers. Go ahead. Just thought their attire was interesting. Go ahead. This is that same guy that had fired an RPG at a tank, and he's coming running back after firing. And I chose to shoot in black and white. Most of my work, I'm known as a color photographer, but when I went to Russia and I saw what it was, to me it was like the Second World War in Stalingrad, so that's why I chose to shoot in black and white.
Uh-huh.
These are Russian prisoners in a basement. They brought me down to show me a room full of Russians that they had captured.
Uh-huh.
And that's just lit by a flashlight.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Does anybody...
These are also Russian prisoners.
Does anybody from either side want to talk to you about what it is you do?
They're very puzzled by why you're there, usually.
Uh-huh.
They don't, they're somewhat amazed that you're willing to be there.
Yeah.
As a foreigner, go ahead. And these were Russian prisoners that were, and these are also Russian prisoners, that they kind of look at you like for help.
Uh-huh.
Like you're there to help them, but I'm not Russian, and I'm a foreigner, and I'm just there to document. But when they see a Westerner or a foreigner, or maybe I'm Russian, there's a glimmer of hope that somebody's there.
Mm-hmm.
But there's really not much you can do because I'm dependent on their captors for transportation.
Yeah.
And it's just in downtown Grozny, like an orphan boy. You can go hang out.
Uh-huh. What percent of the population was left? When you were there?
Mostly it was left was elderly Russian population.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the dead you saw, this is an elderly Russian woman returning to see her street where her home was destroyed. Go ahead and change it. somebody killed. You can go ahead and change. Go a little faster. This picture is interesting. I don't even remember taking it, and I found it on my contact sheet later. It was very near the front line. This was when I was trying to get to the presidential palace.
Uh-huh.
But it was interesting, this man standing there, he's holding an RPG, and the woman, and that weird barber hanging up there. It was just a weird kind of street scene. It was funny, uh-huh. I don't even remember taking the picture. You can go ahead.
Is that because you take so many?
Just kind of, the intensity uh-huh. of the day, you kind of forget about little quiet moments. This is a Chechen sniper. People don't realize either, when the sniper fires a gun in a room, you feel like blood's going to come out of your ears. It's so loud.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to photograph like doing that. And
do you just take earplugs with you?
And the problem is with earplugs, you put earplugs in, you can't hear. Yeah. You can't hear if you're
right.
crossing the street and there's a slight like whistling sound uh-huh. that is made. This is just on the road into Grozny.
So if something was going to be shot,
change it.
That you'd be able to, you'd hear it first?
You want to be able to hear if somebody's shooting at you.
Uh-huh.
And earplugs, the few times I put it in, I found out that's an annoyance. This is a group that I had worked with. Of Chechens. You can tell they're a nice group of people. Mm. Go ahead and change it.
Are there any
These
women?
Are now more portraits. Yeah, you'll see some. Now this is kind of a series of portraits of the Chechens I did. To me, it's kind of like the businessman going to work. Go ahead and change.
Uh-huh. What did he have in his bag?
I don't know. This was a Grenades? Young boy in the palace that uh-huh. was trying to leave when I was trying to leave. You can go ahead. Trying to gauge the moment when to kind of cross, there's more Chechen fires, just more portraits of people. I also find that photography is a real, like an anthropological kind of study.
Yeah.
You document cultures and people. There's a woman, her husband was one of the guys that was near that, in that group photo, but there she is with her machine gun and mm-hmm. just kind of...
Were there many women involved in Chechnya?
Yeah, there were. There were women involved in fighters, mm-hmm. women involved in the aid of the wounded, mm-hmm. which surprisingly for an Islamic culture.
Yeah.
Go ahead. It's refugees, people trying to get out of town. Go ahead. Go ahead. And these are all kind of real quick, I'll go through. These are just landscapes. This is the view. I don't even know if you can really appreciate it, but this is the view outside the presidential palace. And the row of houses just back yeah. there, that's where the Russian positions are. And you
yeah.
see the destruction.
Yeah.
And to say to yourself, you have to get out and run out of that building, it's quite frightening. Go ahead.
So how do you do that? I mean, if you figure they're on the other side.
You just wait, maybe for a moment, maybe a quiet moment.
Do you try to
and
get
all this
low,
destruction, or? People don't realize we saw this took place in a 3-week period. That's how much the Russians did to Grozny in 3 weeks of the war of bombing. They basically bombed it 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. And that's the hardest thing in photography to convey is the destruction of it. And that's why most of the time we're there, we're spent in the basements.
Yeah.
You're in the basements of these.
That
these
definitely communicates destruction.
Yeah. And this is after they had captured it. This is the presidential palace where I took those pictures. And there's like the front door. That's the door that you had to run uh-huh. in. You had to basically run across this whole square to a building that's just behind us. But this is after the Russians had captured it. And go ahead. This is a mortar. That's a small mortar that lands in the street, and you see that? That's the fragmentation of metal that flies out. This is a neighborhood where I had slept at. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, and where was that?
Still in Grozny.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's it. You can just hit Command W. Command. The Apple W there. Should close it. And what's this next one? Hit the F9 for a second. F9 or F10, yeah. And you'll see which number 2 is the war in Iraq. You can just hit Command A, Apple A. now go up to image and hit slideshow. Should work. I'm an Apple user. A lot of people are. Questions, anybody? The only time usually is when they're with either a loved one that's wounded or dying, and they'll ask. You can kind of gauge when somebody doesn't want to be photographed. Also, you have to be very careful with fighters, guys with guns, Chechens. You don't usually you want to feel them out first before you just start taking their photograph. This leads up to now. I had told my wife and my family that I wouldn't do conflict, and then September 11th happened, and this is the war in Iraq, the invasion in Iraq. I went because I was in my career. I was known as a war photographer, and I kind of always use that uh-huh. if I ever do a whole group thing on my career, it won't look good if I don't cover U.S. invading Iraq or Afghanistan. So that's how I convinced my wife to let me go back and. That. And that was kind of on the eve of the invasion, and this is the unit I was with. I was embedded. I wasn't an official embed. It was, all right, because my wife was, I was supposed to embed, but my wife was pregnant with our second child, and she gave birth on March 8th, and March 10th I was back. In the embed, you had to be there by like March 1st.
I see, uh-huh.
So it was kind of like waiting for the baby to be uh-huh. born so I could go and,
uh-huh.
and went right after.
Uh-huh.
And kind of hooked up with a unit, uh-huh. not officially.
So
but I was embedded, but not officially embedded.
How did you do that?
Well, through Time had a writer that was embedded, and uh-huh. I had convinced Time magazine. Where I live in Florida, my neighbor was a retired colonel in the Army. He's only been retired a year. He worked at SOCOM, the Special Forces Command.
Oh, sure.
And
yes.
I had convinced Time to let me bring him over as my translator driver.
Oh, uh-huh.
So we hired him as my, and he knew some of the generals.
Yeah.
And because I was originally going to go in unilaterally, having to drive across the border myself, and I was worried about not so much the Iraqis, I was worried about the Kuwaiti police and the American military not allowing media access to the battlefield.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to have somebody
right.
who had the maps. He was a helicopter pilot. So that's kind of how I was able to get
into the politics.
And this is just kind of my work going in.
So what was the group you were with?
Third Infantry Division.
Where'd you go from?
We went from near the border. We went up to Nasiriyah, the mm-hmm. Talil Air Base, which is this is that during the first mm-hmm. days, and eventually all the way to Baghdad through Karbala.
Uh-huh.
It was actually, I did the first Gulf War, and this one was actually one of the more physical ones in the sense of the environment and being outdoors. Mm-hmm. It was 21 days, basically 21 days to Baghdad,
mm-hmm.
living outside in the elements, and you can go ahead and change. This is the unit I was with. And,
what are the similarities and differences of being with a group and taking pictures?
It's interesting because there's all this complaints by a lot of people about embedding. They feel that embedding takes away from your journalistic integrity, that you become too close to your subject. But for me, I disagree. I feel that embedding is the best way to document anything. It's like the pictures you saw from Chechnya. I basically embedded myself with those people.
Yeah.
If you just show up and you try to be so impartial, the people aren't going to behave the way they would normally behave. That if you embed with them and live with them and basically you're sleeping and eating together, mm-hmm. you become their friends,
mm-hmm.
like their politics or not like their politics. You have to get your subject to accept you as one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that the only way to do that is to embed.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can show try to show without some mm-hmm. impartiality the truth of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
There are issues that do come up where you don't document something that you see because you realize it will jeopardize your friendship. And for me, those are always kind of a balance. If I'm with the Chechens and I see them beating some Russian. I have to say to myself, am I going to photograph that now and risk all my access? So I might have to censor myself and say, I'm not going to document that. Because maybe up the road they're going to massacre 20 children or 20 civilians. It's like a card game. At what point am I going to show my true hand? At which show am I going to document? I saw the unit I was with did some looting when they reached Baghdad. They wanted Coca-Cola, cigarettes. You know, they broke into shops, broke into stores. And I censored myself. I didn't photograph that because I knew that if I photographed that, the unit would get in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And it would be seen wrongly. And the reason I don't do that is because I'm more concerned with what's going to happen down the road. What's going to happen if a vehicle comes down the road and they kill a busload of civilians? That's the photograph I'm going to want to take. I'm not going to want to jeopardize my relationship over a pack of cigarettes. Uh-huh. So yeah, for me, there is some internal censorship. It's not a censorship that comes from my editors. It does not come from my magazine. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an internal personal censorship.
Can you take the picture and then decide that you're going to censor yourself
later? No, the problem is with taking it is the people you're taking is they're stealing the cigarettes and they see you photograph them. They know you work for Time Magazine. They're going to say, whoa, wait a second. Uh-huh. What are you doing with that? Are you crazy? Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to get me, you know. So it's best just to leave that. You have to kind of play. That's where the internal censor, where I did see them kill some civilians, and I did take those pictures, and they did question me, why am I taking those pictures? Uh-huh. So there's a balance. Right. Those are whole issues with embedding. Go ahead. This was during this amazing sandstorm, two-day sandstorm. And they were looking for an RPG team that was attacking convoys. At this point, we were on called convoy protection. Uh-huh. Because we had to kind of go backwards, just come back to protect convoys, because the convoys in the rears were being attacked. Uh-huh. And they were searching. Go ahead.
What happens to your camera?
It was difficult because the camera was wet and sandy, and the camera gets... And when it dries, it like turns to mortar, almost like a cement. Uh-huh. The gear took a beating. Uh-huh. Plus, we're shooting digital, and you have to have a laptop and a satellite telephone and all that. This is the unit I rode with in the vehicle. You can go ahead and change. This is in when I finally got, I had to leave my unit because we were originally tasked to take an area just outside the airport. Because things went so quickly, the unit I went with got redirected to the north of Baghdad, and instead of taking the airport and some of the palaces, we ended up at a water treatment facility. Basically, we ended up protecting a sewage treatment plant. Mm-hmm. So when I got to Baghdad on April 6th, that's 3 days before the statue came down, I'm with a unit, but I'm listening to the BBC, and I'm on communication telephone with my office. I know that there's U.S. troops in the palaces, and I know I don't need to be with a unit that's guarding a water treatment plant. I have to get myself to the palace, and I actually left my unit. Where that last picture came from. They're kind of out of order here. This is a farmer that was killed for not stopping his vehicle in time in Karbala. This is when we first reached Baghdad on the 6th of April. He was a soldier, and he was blown out of his vehicle, maybe 15 feet down into a ditch. And I'm actually the one who found them, because I actually got out of the vehicle, because we were going through, and they weren't stopping. They were, like, fighting, and there were a lot of dead and wounded Iraqis pretty much everywhere. Uh-huh. And I wanted to get out of the vehicle. And I actually jumped out of the vehicle and was going along the road photographing what I thought were dead Iraqis, but it turned out a bunch of them were alive. I even had one that... you can go to the next frame. This guy here, I had actually found, he looked like he was dead, and I was taking his picture, and he reached up and he grabbed my leg and totally freaked me out. I'm like kind of dressed in I look like American military, and I don't have a gun, and I'm down there with all these kind of like dead and I thought were dead people, and all of a sudden one of them's alive, and he's got me by the pants. And so they came and they got Actually, this isn't that guy. This is the guy from the ditch that they pulled out. I don't think I have a frame of that one. Go ahead and change. These are some of the people that were blown out of the vehicles. You can go ahead and change it. It's the pictures that never get published. Even like this, I really wanted time to publish this. It was this week, but they didn't want it. They were looking for pictures of children with flowers and the statue coming down. Uh-huh. They didn't want to publish pictures of the battle for Baghdad.
Yeah.
And this was basically body collection. To get the bodies off the road. And they basically just dig a hole in the ground, put the body in, and just cover it up. Civilians, these last two are just civilians, just basically people caught up in the fighting.
Yeah.
Go ahead. It's in Baghdad. All these are in Baghdad. Go ahead. Searching for weapons. Go ahead. And it's funny because in all my years, I've covered 20 conflicts. And in all my years of covering conflicts, I could always tell when people felt that they were being liberated. You could see it on their face. I don't care if it's Somalia, Panama, you could see it on people's faces. You could see by the way people waved. The minute we crossed the border in Iraq, you did not feel that. You did not feel that all the way to Baghdad. You did not. People were afraid. You didn't see the...
Uh-huh.
I mean, I realized there was some footage of it, but I never saw it.
Uh-huh.
And it was hard for me because my office kept asking me for those pictures. And I never saw those pictures.
Yeah.
I never saw anybody throwing flowers on our vehicles as we came up the road.
Were they willing to use ones that showed what the response really was?
No. They have this whole editorial, the mood of the country at the time was the liberation of Baghdad. We left the water treatment plant to protect the garbage dump. So I'm sitting there while Baghdad's being liberated. And it was just ironic, this white horse came running up the road. And I don't like the picture.
Yeah, it is. You do wonder what
that. Command W if you want. Apple W. And then hit F9. And you go to the bush black and white. So it kind of takes us to what I do now is because of my family, I don't really like covering conflict. I prefer, I needed a steady job in the business and there's not a lot of steady jobs in photojournalism. So now I cover the White House for time. I think you have to hit Command A first, sorry. Yeah, and then go up to that selects all the images. This next body of work was shot last month. It's with the Bush administration. I don't know what it was like under the Clinton administration or past administrations because I didn't do it. I didn't cover the White House. I never really aspired to cover the White House. Access is very limited at the White House. You do basically like what we did today. You're brought into the cabinet meeting. You're in there for a couple minutes. You do pictures. It's all a lot of photo ops. The pictures you're going to look at now are kind of rare because Bush knew he was up for Man of the Year. His people knew he was up for the Man of the Year. So they kind of opened their door for Time magazine. But even then, initially, when it started, it was quite slow. To them, behind-the-scenes photograph is to bring you into the Oval Office. You're in there for 15 seconds, and then they ask you to leave. And it's not the president that asks you to leave, it's one of his aides. At the time it was either Dan Bartlett or they have one of the lower press people there that's with you that ask you to leave the Oval Office. And I knew that I was not going to be able to produce a photographic essay on the president that shows him as the man of the year by that type of access. So after the second or third day, I had an opportunity where Bush went out onto the South Lawn where I went out with him and I kind of asked him directly that, you know, this isn't going to work with 15-second photo ops. And he just basically told me, don't relax, we're going to give you what you want. And from that day on, it just opened up. I was able to do a whole week of behind the scenes with him. So you can go ahead and show. This is him in the Oval.
When you're taking pictures of him, to what extent is he always aware that you're there?
Well, it's rare the fact that a journalist is around him. He knows that Time magazine is there. He knows that you're a photographer, that you are going to make an image of him. He's very self-conscious of that. Mm-hmm. When I first, at one point, when I was first in the Oval Office, he had a cigar in his hand. And you are not allowed to take a picture of him with a cigar in his hand. But they kind of tell you that way beforehand, but if you walk in and you don't see it, but the minute I start taking a picture, he also realizes it, and he quickly puts the cigar away. Uh-huh. Because he doesn't want an image of him. He's not smoking it, he's just holding an unlit cigar.
Uh-huh.
There's little things like that. There's little protocols that they ask you to please abide by.
How but did you take that stance?
He was actually getting irritated because they were waiting for these new ambassadors. Mm-hmm. And it was the new ambassador for Chad.
Oh, yeah.
And he's waiting for them to bring him in, and he's waiting. Yeah, and he's finally snapping it, like, you know, where is he? Let's go.
What time were they due, and how behind were they?
Well, he was probably 30 seconds behind or a minute. Uh-huh. Just the fact he was having to wait. And plus, he's got a Time magazine photographer there taking a picture of him. It's like, let's get this
on the road. He does look irritated.
But another photographer, Charles Avani from Newsweek, taught me early on, because he was up for Man of the Year in 2001, and I got to do a week behind the scenes. First time I got to go in the Oval Office. And he says, most people are very timid. They walk into the Oval Office, and it's kind of intimidating. You're in there with the president. It's just kind of you and the president and maybe one other person. And Charles is the one who told me. He says, look, he knows you're there. You're there to do a job. Take full advantage of it. Mm-hmm. Meaning, walk behind him. Get next to the trash can. Come right up to him. Do it from here. Don't just stand off in the corner and be real meekish, because this is rare. These opportunities are rare. So I take that to the full extent. Uh-huh. I move myself, I go behind them, you know, unless somebody's going to say, look, don't do that, but, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was a good piece of advice. Go ahead and advance. And this, they come in for their morning meeting. And it was interesting, prior to this, I always had to leave, but since I had that talk with them, they let me stay. Usually, I had to do my 15 seconds and leave. This time, I was actually able to stay in the rooms during the meetings. The only one I wasn't was the daily, the CIA briefing. Uh-huh. I had to go out of. And here he's actually irritated. He's irritated about, this is Andy Carden Cheney, he's snapping about something that's in a speech he's supposed to give. Uh-huh. And it's something about there, the wording of God. Uh-huh. He was very irritated that was in there, and he wanted it taken out. Like, who put it in there? And just whatever. It's interesting. The other interesting point is I'm not supposed to talk about certain things I see or hear, yeah. So I have to be careful, because that's part of the thing they ask you. Everything's kind of off the record.
Uh-huh.
And this is Blake. This is his personal assistant on the back, very young. And he's the one who, once the president said it was okay, I worked with Daley to get access to. It's Blake. Uh-huh. He's actually one of the most powerful people in the White House, is this young personal assistant to the president. Go ahead. And this is him going over his schedule. It's even this. Somebody had put this book here, God, facing me, knowing that time's going to be in there. And the minute he saw that, he immediately took it off and put it in his desk. It's interesting, because everybody thinks, at least the religious right in the country, thinks that the president is just so, you know, religious and back on the Christians and the born-again Christians in the country. But from my time around the president, be it in open press events and behind the scenes, I find him, he's always saying that, you know, about the nation, is he has to be a president to everybody, to the Buddhists, you know, Judaism, you know, Islam, everything. He's very very adamant about that, and to with his staff. And I see him say that a lot. I don't know if it carries over, like during the campaign and how the campaign went, with the image that they try to portray him. But that's the kind of thing I think that he knows, image-wise, he's worried about, because he realized it's a nation of many religions. Right. He's not just the president for the Christians in America. You go ahead. Here he was talking with the opposition in Ukraine. Uh-huh. This was during the Ukrainian crisis. And there's some State Department. It's interesting to see them make calls to world leaders, how that's done. They have a phone. It's kind of interesting to see how they do that.
So Condi's on the phone.
There's a speakerphone going on.
Uh-huh.
And there's two of her State Department people that make the call, and she's there.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, she's not even. She wasn't State Department yet. She's
right,
there.
Yeah.
go ahead, national security. But there were two, like, State Department people there. And this is kind of after a morning meeting, a little laughter. Go ahead. This is the breaking up of a meeting. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. This is like the assistant. They have peepholes on all the doors in the Oval, and this is actually into the Roosevelt Room, and it's during one of the cabinet announcing, and he's waiting. Uh-huh. Blake is waiting to see, so when the president turns, is walking, Blake knows exactly when to open the door. Uh-huh. So he, Blake kind of sits there and he watches through the little peephole.
And then when the president has given a speech, Blake, before he gives the speech, Blake brings the speech in right beforehand, and then after he's spoken, he comes and he picks it up so that they have the record of that speech, that they have that text, and it doesn't get
early
lost.
Early on in the administration, there were times where they forgot the speech and people would actually
take the speech
or photograph the speech. So they're very good at quickly getting up there and rounding them up. I'm going to change. And this was during the, that morning. It was weird. This was actually my first day. They said, okay, you're going to get the behind the scenes. They brought me in. I didn't even know what the meeting was. And there was this man and the woman, Condi Rice, and the president. And it was the new CIA director, Portergos, mm-hmm. who I didn't know who. I didn't recognize him. Uh-huh. And I kept trying to crop him out of the photograph because I thought he was just some State Department. And he was going to ruin my photograph. And it wasn't until I left that I realized, darn it, that's the new CIA guy. And but this is a thing of example of I'm literally standing right over him. I'm not once I saw that that's his daily, it's called the putter, his daily presidential brief by the CIA. I want a picture of that.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to be shy and say, can I attend? I'm just going to go in and take a picture of it.
Uh-huh.
And go ahead. And this was, I got to sit in on a Social Security meeting in the cabinet room with the bipartisan congressional. Mm-hmm. They had both members of the House there, both Democrat and Republican, which is also very interesting to sit in on the whole meeting and hear them go talk about Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Just go ahead.
How long were those kinds of meetings?
It was almost 2 hours.
Oh.
But I couldn't take pictures for 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
I could take pictures at the top and take pictures at the bottom. So I had to sit in there through the whole meeting. And this is him walking back to the residency from the Oval Office. Just go ahead. Put it on. And go ahead. This is, I really like this picture because it's a rare picture. He has a daily luncheon with the Vice President. And this is just off the Oval Office. This is the private dining room, and that's the private, that little door there is the little private study of the president. Mm-hmm. That's where Clinton and Monica were hanging out. And it's the dining room. And I just like this photo. Bush is talking to a member of the Senate. And go ahead. It's kind of him at the end of the day. I kind of have to wait a lot in the secretary area, and sometimes the door opens up, so I'll shoot a picture through the door as I'm waiting to come in. Go ahead. And these are also very rare. It's rare that they allow anybody on Marine One. He flew to Bethesda to get his medical checkup and to visit the troops.
Yeah.
And they took me along with him. This is actually after, before we're taking off the hospital. And he was almost, he was very moved by what he just went through. He visited 40-something wounded soldiers and families, and some of them very severely wounded, and it deeply affected him. His eyes were actually watering up, and at one point, he looked at me after, right after this, maybe three or four more pictures, and asked me not to take any more pictures, because he was starting to cry, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Not like tears, but he was choked up, actually, about what he saw. Go ahead. And this, to me, is just, it's weird, because I'm sitting in the, he called it the Queen's chair. I'm sitting in the First Lady's chair. And this is what you, as a photographer, you're always on the outside, and you see the Marine Guard to go up and open up the door. So when I look out the window, and here comes the Marine Guard, I want to have a picture of it. So that's what that is, us landing at the hospital. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's true.
And this is him getting off to get into the limousine. But you see, it's as a photojournalist, I'm taking full advantage of the situation. Mm-hmm. I'm not letting who he is overwhelm me. I'm going to photograph everything that I can, because I know that this is very rare. Mm-hmm. It's recently, there was a photographer during the State of the Union that was on the floor. They allow one pool photographer to be on the floor. Mm-hmm. And this year, I won't say who it was, but I was up high and I watched him, and he wasn't taking pictures. He was waiting for the president to come out. But he's got the Supreme Court, he's got the cabinet, he's got the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's standing all there right next to him, and he's not taking pictures. Mm-hmm. Because he thinks he's there just to do the speech. But they've given you permission to be on the floor, so you need to really take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Also very rare to for them to allow you in the limousine. Go ahead.
It looks like seal is on everything.
Pretty much. This is one of the troops. I mean, and to them, there's some gain for them to finally... They've never allowed this to be photographed. It's always a handout. The reason they've never allowed it to photograph, it's a very private time with the families and the troops. You can go ahead to the next one. They're very small rooms, and they don't really want a lot of media. It's just too private.
Yeah.
He was giving Purple Hearts to some of them. Most of the wounded here are Marines from Fallujah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
How long ago were they injured?
They were injured in the big fight in Fallujah, so it was like a couple months. This is his military aide would read the diploma, the diploma for the Purple Heart. Mm-hmm. Very moving to come in. Mm-hmm. The commander-in-chief presents you with, and some of them are like comatose, brain dead.
Are there families usually there?
50% had families, and I probably... He did like 47 of them. I probably went into maybe 15 or 20 just to give him his space, because it was just too overwhelming. Yeah. It's a small room. Yeah. You can go ahead. Go ahead. Just flying back to the White House. That's where I sat, so then I would move over. You go ahead. And this arriving back at the South Lawn. See, and not asking anybody on the helicopter, can I go out the door behind him? Because if he asks, somebody might say no. So I'm just going to take full advantage of the opportunity. You go ahead. And then as he turns to walk to stand on the stairs. Go ahead.
Work on the principle of ask for forgiveness, not permission.
This is interesting. On the Saturday, he goes bike riding. Mm-hmm. And this is actually in the control vehicle, and this is the mill aid, and that's they call it the suitcase. That's the nuclear suitcase that always travels with the president.
How big is that? Does it go down?
No, it's just to here, the to frame. There? It's just a big size, like an airline suitcase. But I felt like, wow, I'm in the vehicle with the suitcase and never let you go there. So also, again, taking advantage of the situation and thought, I can go ahead and change it. And this president about to go bike riding. And it was interesting. I look up and he's got these white earphones. I said, shoot, he's got an iPod. And you go to the next frame, he gets on the bike and he rides away. But then he stops because his iPod's not working, and he gets out. And I'm like 30 feet away. When I saw him pull out that iPod, I'm like, I got to get a picture of this. I ran, past the Secret Service, ran right up to him and started taking a picture. And you can actually see it's Van Morrison, brown-eyed girl he's listening to. But I'm literally arm to arm to him here. It's like, I'm not going to, you don't ask anybody. I'm going, And actually, the 7 website where these pictures were posted, we don't get a lot of hits because it's a weird photojournalism website. All of a sudden, we went from like 300 to 1,000 hits a day to like 30,000 a day because of this iPod photo. It just ended up, I could, but approach me. Go ahead. You don't really know it's the president, though. It's not his face, but you just have to take my word on it. There he is riding.
How fast does he go?
He goes fast. He's a hard rider. He's in shape. He's very good shape. Go ahead. So you see, it's a pretty extensive take over a week period.
Yeah.
You can go ahead. Go ahead.
How often does Barney come in?
He shows up a lot, actually. He just kind of... This is the Medal of Freedoms that they were giving out. This is in the Blue Room. This is a tenant and his wife. Go ahead. Yeah. And this is him practicing putting the medal on General Tommy Franks.
Yeah. That was interesting because I remember seeing the ceremony itself.
Yes, this is prior to the ceremony. Well, he didn't. He just didn't want to be fumbling it there.
Sure.
He says, let me try one out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to make sure
he does
it.
That's good for them, too, to know what the deal
ahead.
Is.
And this is them before they go out into the East Room for the formal ceremony.
Yeah.
You can go ahead.
So it's Bremer, too. So it was the three.
This is interesting. There's something weird was going on. She said something to him, and he didn't seem too happy with it. You know? It's like... I'm not quite sure what it was. Go ahead. She actually went out too early, and she's coming back. But this is the other thing. It's like nobody says where I can go or can't go, so I'm going to follow him, you know, taking full advantage. Go ahead.
Yeah.
This is after the event. They come in, and they get their picture taken with the president. Go ahead. This is also very rare. For this president, it's rare. This is inside the elevator of the residence. Mm-hmm. He's going to go to an evening reception. I didn't get into the residence, but I had to sit outside the little foyer area, and they came out and got in the elevator, and I rode down in the elevator with them. It's small, the elevator.
Mm-hmm. Looks that way.
There's one Secret Service agent, us, and then one aide to the First Lady's aide. Go ahead. She's cleaning his, because she knows, you know, Time Magazine's taking his picture. And this is just in the oval.
Yeah.
It was
it's a nice one.
One of the ambassador's daughters.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead. End of the day. Go ahead. That's pretty much it there.
Okay.
And so you can see it's a complete opposite of where I come from in my career to go from doing conflicts to covering the White House.
What things prepared you for it, though? Looks like there are a lot of things that, as far as how you do your work. It certainly is built on how you learned your environment.
Taking advantage of, it's the same in conflict, that thing, many situations I've been with photographers, they get to the event and they're so overwhelmed with the event that they forget why they're there to document and they don't come away with a body of work. For as long as I've been doing it, I understand that the moments are so rare that I want to produce a body of work. I don't want to have to come back. Especially in conflict, there is no going back to it. To get a week with the president in the Oval Office, there's no going back. You can't say, well, I didn't really do a good job. Can I come back next week and try it again? So you've got to be prepared to give it your fullest.
No do-overs.
No do-overs. You can show this next. It also, the day-to-day coverage of the president is very mundane. A lot of speeches. And I was concerned, and my editors were concerned, how I was going to photograph the White House. After September 11th, I started to pick up on a certain feeling in the country that, I don't know the right words, but it bothered me, the fact that, because I lived overseas for so long and I had the very international perspective, I felt in this country the patriotism and nationalism, a lot of the wars that I saw overseas were based on nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And America started to scare me after September 11th. The patriotism of wrapping themselves in the flag, the everything from freedom fries to bashing the French, bashing the Germans, anything that wasn't American.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, we just became a very ugly nation. I still love the country. I love what it stands for. But following Bush around the country for 3 years, I really started to feel a certain vibe that bothered me. So I started shooting in a certain way, and this is a body of a work. It's a book. I don't really know the name of the book, but I kind of call it My New Republic or My America. And it's just kind of my coverage of the mm-hmm. last several years of the presidency. You can look, and it's where that last shot, if you go back to it, it's like, to me, it's the American eagle, and you see it everywhere. And prior to September 11th, I just looked at it as the American eagle, eagle of freedom. But since September 11th, you travel around the world, that doesn't represent freedom to the rest of the world. That takes on a whole new meaning in the rest of the world, that eagle of freedom. And it's just so present everywhere, just around the White House. So go ahead. Right. So that's kind of... And I noticed, and keep going, there's a lot, so we'll go quickly. I noticed that people were... Keep going. It's almost like a study of... I don't want to call... You can go through them kind of quickly. Get like a second or two on each one. It's more of portraitures of people and how they look. It was almost kind of like the zombie nation kind of thing that I was picking up at certain speeches and stuff. So a lot of it deals with, you'll see security, Secret Service agents, but it's just kind of a look that everybody has when the president is speaking. They kind of just have this certain look.
So do you think is that pretty universal, no matter where he speaks? That it's not different on a campaign event as opposed to a regular event?
No, because the regular event, they're all the same. They're usually people that are mm-hmm. from his party, mm-hmm. people that really adore the president mm-hmm. on the whole. Mm-hmm. And it's also shooting, this is Mrs. Blair in Turkey getting on the car. You go through. It's all kind of like a weird, some of it's kind of quirky. This is Bremer mm-hmm. in the Oval Office. Secret Service. It's just, it always takes me the men in dark suits in weird places. Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead.
Were they hunting?
No, he was at some wildlife preserve. Agents everywhere. Because it was new to me. I had not worked in America for 10 years. Mm-hmm. This was all new to me, traveling across America and seeing America like this. You can go ahead.
But do you think a lot of that, of all the security with the president, that really has been there since
it's
the Kennedy,
always, yeah, it's
since
always
the Kennedy
been there.
Administration?
It's always been there. It's just, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. This is more of my, like, color work.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Georgia,
go ahead.
Coming
at you, tell you to...
Go ahead. But just the whole country to me is just a nation of fear. You know, to me, mm-hmm. that's the way I feel. There's just always this, you know, with Homeland Security and all these orange alerts. Uh-huh. And
do you, in your months off, do you, in doing other work, do you go around? Are some of those pictures taken?
No, all this is traveling with the president.
Do you find the same thing when you're not traveling with the president?
Yeah, if I travel through airports, mm-hmm. there's a certain mood where I live. Plus, I still do, in my off months, I still go overseas. I've been to Saudi Arabia several times. I still go to Europe. So I still get a feel of how America is viewed in the world. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. It's really hard to see him on this screen. Go ahead. It's just kind of my, like, quirky look on America. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions while we're going through?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, yes.
How was your perception at the beginning?
At the beginning, I didn't really, to be honest with you, I know this is kind of on the record and this is recorded. I wasn't really fond of the president. I guess I had certain preconceived things about him that I did not like. But on a personal level, I actually like the president. Do I like his policies? No. Do I like the way he's brought the country? No. But do I like him as a person? Yeah.
Towson, do you have a question? Yeah, while we're...
Just speak in here.
As you see, the flag is represented everywhere. I'm just driving around. This is like in the motor. It's just the eagle. It's everywhere. Eagle of Freedom, the Washington Monument, this Arlington Cemetery in the back.
We have somebody from Towson?
This is actually interesting. This is in Gitmo, Cuba. This is in Cuba with a McDonald's. This is a detention center.
But not on the base.
This is on the base.
On the base, yeah. Yeah.
Why don't you just yell? I have a question.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Morris, you said after 9/11, America began to scare you, and that you felt intimidated by this rise in patriotism. You said crossed over into more just flat-out nationalism. That hanging around the president that made you feel different about that, or changed your opinion in a way. Could you elaborate more on that?
It's not so much. It was the way that I saw that. See, I did not cover Clinton, so I don't know how the American public, there's a lot of it that I feel is probably carried over because he's the president of the United States. Uh-huh. But I did not cover, I didn't cover Clinton, so I don't really know that that feeling. It's just that there's a certain mood and feeling that I got at the political rallies that I went to cover with the president that kind of scared me. Mm-hmm. It's just hard. It's just kind of a personal feeling. I've spent a lot of time in around the world and in other cultures, plus also being with the U.S. troops when they invaded Iraq, living with the troops, seeing how they regarded Arabs and, you know, the war, you know, Saddam Hussein, and its payback for 9/11. I even had a general tell me that the war was payback for 9/11. And, mm-hmm. It's just kind of, just the whole thing kind of snowballed to me, just this whole kind of wrapping themselves in the fire. It was so much that even during the campaign that I felt that there were people, Republicans and people that were so in love with the president, felt that Kerry was a disgrace to even that he shouldn't even be allowed to have an American flag behind him. That only, you know, how dare Kerry even wrap himself in the flag. And that kind of bothered me. I don't know if that answers your question.
Here?
So you're saying that it enhanced it?
Yeah, just the whole, if I was just the average citizen not covering the White House, definitely. I was thrown into a political campaign for the presidency of supporters that were in love, people that get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and stand in line for hours to go see somebody talk. They're pretty passionate about that man. So, but to do that day in and day out, 30 straight days, 5 rallies a day, you really pick up on that spiritual vibe that these people put on. Mm-hmm. I mean, here, it's like, look at this guy. The president is speaking. This guy adores the president. I'm 3-4 feet from him taking his picture. He doesn't see me taking his picture. He's in love with the president. That president can do nothing wrong. This was the thing that scared me about America. It's that this overzealous passion for our country and our leaders. It's the thing in all the conflicts I've covered that I saw what brought about conflict and hatred. You know, and we see it in this country in the sense of the division with blue states, red states, and Even on the left here, the country, the people that hate Bush, I mean, they really hate Bush. He's like the devil to them. It's that same kind of thing.
Did you cover Kerry?
I just did 3-4 days. Time wanted me to go out and do it, which was interesting.
Did you find the rallies similar?
Completely different. Mm-hmm. People were different. It was funny. I told Tom, I wish I had brought the Kerry pictures, because I told Tom I didn't want to cover it because I didn't want to photograph people in Birkenstocks and tie-dye T-shirts. I liked my people in suits. And so my first rally, I looked for tie-dye T-shirts and Birkenstocks, so I would send them those pictures, because the people were definitely different.
Questions here? Another one?
Well, my question is, by covering Mr. Bush the way you did, you certainly fulfill a certain task for the Time magazine, and you bring a certain kind of image of Mr. Bush on the paper. For me, it looked very heroic, even human, as you pointed out, you begin to like him. So this is totally different from what you did before, if you talk about the function of the photos. So my question is, do you draw any distinction between what you photograph?
The thing is, when I do like this body of work, I'm still doing this body of work. Working for Time, I'm there. They've nominated him for the Man of the Year, and it's a good question. If when you're around the presidency, he has a very, strong. He's a strong figure. So yes, if they look heroic, it's kind of the way he looks. Like when he was waiting for the ambassador to chat, I got down on my knees for a purpose. I want to look up at the president. I'm trying not to look down on the president. It is, to be honest with you, it's a pure document. It's my vision. Mm-hmm. Like this is my vision. I shoot these rallies a certain way. You'll notice there's very few pictures of the president in this body of work. But there are certain pictures I have to shoot for Time because they're the ones that pay for everything. Time has run, if I'm showing you 130 pictures of my New Republic series, they've probably mm-hmm. published four. So I have to provide a product for the mm-hmm. organization that's hired me. Go ahead. But I still try to give it my edge, mm-hmm. my kind of angle.
If you were invited, would you, before 2003, would you have covered Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I would have cherished the idea of to have an opportunity to photograph Saddam Hussein mm-hmm. and to do a day in the life of Saddam Hussein. Go ahead.
Towson, do you have a question?
Yeah. Mr. Morris, at any time during the Iraq War, did you have a conflict with U.S. military personnel over any pictures? I mean, did they ever forbid you to take anyone's?
No. Never. And there were discussions of... Plus, I did the first Gulf War, which was even more restrictive. But both times I was embedded with the military, I was never really told that I could not take. Some pictures I took, they questioned why I was taking it, and then I would have to give them a good answer. But there was no kind of censorship or what I could or could not photograph. The only times I couldn't photograph things is because there were logistics. I could not get from point A to point B to do it. And if they didn't want me to go there, they wouldn't provide me a vehicle. Go ahead.
Mr. Morris, question about internal censorship mm-hmm. and different levels of internal censorship. Have you had any conflict with, say, Time Magazine with your Man of the Year issue? What they actually printed and what you wanted them to print?
No, there's some discussion of some images that I like over other images, and we kind of go back and forth of what they feel is a mm-hmm. better picture. But if I don't want them to publish it, I don't have to give them the picture. I'm the one that sends them the take. So if I've given it to them, then I'm comfortable uh-huh. with them publishing it. So no, there's real no, that's what I like about uh-huh. photographing in the digital format now. It is, before we used to have to ship them film and we wouldn't see the material, we couldn't control it. Digital has enabled the photographer to have much more control over their work.
Uh-huh. Do you...
Even the wire photographers that shoot, if they don't want to put it on the wire, they don't send it.
Uh-huh. When you did the Man of the Year pictures, did you have an idea of what you thought formed the complete body? That there were, say you sent 50 pictures and that they represented different aspects of him?
It's kind of like what I showed you. That's kind of like my edit. That's not uh-huh. Time's edit. Those are the pictures I kind of mm-hmm. like. For me, I was happy to ride on the helicopter and get in the car uh-huh. just because I had never seen that before.
Yeah. Here.
In the campaign pictures that you had of Bush, most people seem to be blonde hair, blue eyes, white, a lot of white people, not very much ethnicity.
I'm asked that. Why don't I photograph African Americans?
I was just wondering, is it a personal choice that you made to photograph certain types of people?
All the photographs are personal choices of people that I see in the crowd that I want to photograph. But if there's 10,000 people in the audience and there's one African American, I'm not going to photograph the one African American. So yes, it is. There are minorities at the rallies, but they are very, very few. You don't see them. That's the first thing I noticed when I went to Cary. There were elderly, there were crippled, there were blacks, there was whites. This is actually Don King. This is African-American, but I cropped his face off. I was more interested in the tie and the diamonds. And the.
Right, yeah.
But everybody I photograph, if I'm attracted to somebody with braces, it's just kind of a certain look. I want to give a representation in the body of the work of the people that I see at the crowds. If they're just not there. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. And behind you.
As an embedded journalist, are there certain guidelines that the Pentagon, that you have to follow, given by the Pentagon?
The ones that were embedded were made to sign. There were some guidelines that they were under, mainly about releasing photographs. If you photographed casualties, if you had some victims that were killed on the ground, you were not allowed to take those photographs, but you were not allowed to transmit them until families were notified. So they were all basic guidelines that are fair. Those types of guidelines. You're not allowed to give out positions. They're all very common sense guidelines. The woman at the Pentagon, what was her name, Ms. Clark? Is she the
Tori
one?
Clark.
Tori Clark, to me, did a fantastic job of preparing to make this a very well-covered war. The only problem is the coverage became very patriotic and very gung-ho about, to me. Because when I came back and I saw the TV footage, I was like, wow. It was amazing for me.
Towson, question?
We got one right here.
Yeah, but let's go back and forth one-on-one. Towson?
Question. I was just wondering, of all your, going from wartime photography to being a photojournalist at the White House, which one gives you more satisfaction as a professional photojournalist?
Yeah. Obviously, the war photography. I mean, this is, photographically, this is very, very challenging, the presidency, because it's all very controlled. We're told where to stand, where we can't stand, when we can shoot, when we can't shoot, when to eat, when to get on the bus, when to get on the plane. It's very, very controlling. So creatively, as a photographer, it's actually much more challenging to come up with unique photographs and unique angles that are different. But the thing is, I don't know how long I can keep doing it to make it interesting where I won't burn out on it. I burned out on the war photography.
You served on the ground in Iraq and took pictures there. You're on the front line with the troops. And then you come back and you're in the White House. You're with President Bush. And it seems like he almost lives in a cocoon there where, I mean, everything's, he's sort of surrounded by the Secret Service and everything. And he's back in Washington, D.C. And I was just wondering, what kind of disconnect do you see between what's actually going on the ground in Iraq and then the, like, living situation the president has and just the physical geography differences that don't allow for, you know, the reports coming from the ground in Iraq to get to the president? What kind of disconnect do you see there?
I don't know. I think watching him go to the hospital, and I know he does it often, and looking at these soldiers in the eyes, the ones, some of them are brain dead in the family, I think he has a very good picture about what he's doing. I think he understands, plus he's briefed. I don't think they hold too much back from him. I maybe personally don't agree with which way he's taking it, but I don't think he's so isolated from reality. I think maybe before he was president, but since he's been president, I think he's really, I think he's aware of what's going on. He sees the reports of casualties.
One more question from each. Towson?
I have one again. Mr. Morris, could you describe, just with the time that we have left, as concisely as possible, your first experience with being in a combat setting, photographing?
My really first, which was, I would say was, there were two. The first true time I ended up with conflict was in 88. I had done some small stuff in Asia, coups and stuff like that. But the first time I ended up in what you would classify as real war, I went to Afghanistan in 88. And I went off near a place called Kandahar with Mujahideen. They were actually, the Russians had left. They were trying to, they were fighting the government in Kabul, the pro-Russian mm-hmm. government in Kabul. And just, we were attacked by airplanes and shelling and all that. And that was the first time. And I didn't do too well photographing. I was by myself. I was with these guys for 20, almost 30 days. Nobody spoke English. Mm-hmm. Living with them, eating with them. Culturally, it was completely a total disconnect. Mm-hmm. But I was determined to make it as a photographer, so mm-hmm. I picked myself up and went off to the next place after that. And I ended up, my really big break, I was in Panama for the invasion. Mm-hmm. There weren't a lot, there were four foreign photographers there during the invasion, and uh-huh. on the first day, three of them were shot, one killed, and the other two were wounded, two of them friends of mine. So there was like a 3-4 day period, I was the only foreign photographer that was working uh-huh. before they allowed the media to come in.
Uh-huh.
And I shot video and stills. So that uh-huh. was kind of like my really big break where time put me on contract right after that.
Uh-huh. When you went to Afghanistan, who were you working for?
I went on my own. Mm-hmm. I had a guarantee from Newsweek and the New York Times Sunday Magazine. The uh-huh. New York Times Sunday Magazine published the photos.
Uh-huh.
But there's all kinds of issues that you encounter in the field you don't realize. You're sleeping. Culturally, I'm with these people. When you wake up and somebody's trying to get in your sleeping bag with you at night, you know, you've got somebody breathing on your face at 4 o'clock in the morning. But these guys, you know, they have guns. There's just all this kind of weird things that you're out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
There's no lifeline. There's no hospitals. There's no telephones.
Uh-huh.
And
so what do you do?
Just zipped, hold on to the zip for the sleeping bag. It's just weird culturally. That's like when we were going to invade Afghanistan. And all my friends were, I was at the White House, and all my friends were going off to Afghanistan. And all my friends here were saying, oh, don't you wish you were there in Afghanistan working? And I had no desire to go back to uh-huh. Afghanistan.
Uh-huh. Roger, do you have a question? Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
To what degree does Time or any media outlet ever shy away from controversial or any provocative images?
I would say often. Very often. They have readership, they have advertising, they have access to, there are certain things they will not show. But as photographers, if I come across some gruesome scene like that, the leg in the road, I'm not going to, Time's never going to publish that photograph, but I'm not going to not take that photograph. I'm going to show it to the editor. Mm-hmm. I want a historic document of what really happens. But Time will never publish that photograph.
When you show a variety of pictures like that, they have in their heads what an idea of what they want, and you show them what actually is. Do you find that that you can convince them to run some of them? That perhaps
sometimes,
not
but they
it?
Are the higher ups in the magazine are very well entrenched in their ideas uh-huh. and their views, and it's very hard to shake that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Chris.
Thank
you. Really enjoyed it very much.